in a world that is controlled by God, and if you believe in God, by definition, you believe in the providence of God, because a theistic view of God tells you that he's omnipresent, he's omniscient, he's all of those things. There would not be anything he would have to learn, something that he could not know. And that is why the scripture is clear that he knows how many hairs you have in your head. Now, if you're over probably 50, he'd probably having to work overtime with you as your hair is becoming thinner. But at any given time, he would know exactly how many hairs are on your head if you were to count them, how many steps you take in a lifetime. This is the providence of God. Wise people understand that. Hannah, the mother of Samuel, understood the providence of God. She was barren for many years, and God blessed her with a child, and her firstborn son was Samuel, the prophet. And when she extolled the Lord for reaching down into her world out of his great providence, way back in chapter 2, this is part of what she said back then. She said, "The Lord kills and he makes alive. He brings down to Sheol," which is just the Old Testament version of the grave, "and he raises up. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low, he also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor." He says, why is all this true? Well, the pillars of the earth are the Lord's. He set the world on them. So when he created the world out of nothing, ex nihilo, and he spoke and it was, he did it all based on his great power, and he's providential, knowing all things. And I'm glad that he knows all things. Because it gives me hope when I walk through life and I don't understand things. I know that I can trust him in how he's leading me, because all of the mundane things that you occur in your life, as I get older, he starts connecting the dots in profound ways that leaves your jaw on the floor. You're like, I had no idea what you were doing in my life at the time, but boy, now I do. And this is a story of the providence of God, chapter 9, of how he's going to lead Israel's first king unto them. It's going to be an amazing way. And as I've told you many times before, if you think the Bible is really boring, you do not read it. Because how God guides Israel to their first king is so interesting and humorous as well. But their story of God's providence is going to be your story, because the same God that guided them to their first king is the same God who's going to guide you. So chapter 8, if you were here last week, it ended with God telling Israel, "I'll give you what you want." "Oh, you want a king and not me? Well, I will give you what you want. You may not like what you get, but I'll give you a king and I'll set that all up." And the whole chapter closed without that happening. Well, chapter 9, God's going to give him a king. And he's going to providentially work in a way that's most interesting. He's going to do it through some animals. It's very interesting. So when you look at picking a politician, since we just went through a presidential process that was most interesting, was it not? Yeah. It is interesting. I went back and I looked at, how's it supposed to go when you pick a presidential candidate? Because you're like, when you think, how did we pick one? Then you have to ask, well, how did God pick this king? I mean, how did Israel wind up with this king? Well, God doesn't do things the way man does. Now, here's a brief chart in case you don't really understand American politics. This is so interesting. What would a day be without some kind of flow chart or something, right? So if you want to be a president, you got to say, hey, I want to run for president. Then what happens? Contact the party chair then decides who will make the list, voters then cast ballots, election officials tabulate the results, Secretary of State shares that report with the party chairs and the public, party sends delegates to the national convention to discuss and pick a nominee. That's how it's supposed to go. And then nominees are then announced, and then what happens? The last service said, chaos. It's fun preaching two times. I mean, it's like, that's what they said. Chaos happens, yeah. God doesn't have a flowchart like that for picking a leader. What does he do? Well, he uses donkeys. He uses donkeys. But how do I know? Well, because I read 1 Samuel chapter 9. Now, he didn't use elephants. He used donkeys. I'm just saying. So you can take that for whatever it's worth. It's an amusing thought that I had when I'm reading this. Because God chose donkeys to use those donkeys to guide Israel's first king to become the king. This is interesting stuff. Verse 1, what happens in what I call the problem? Well, they want a king. So how does God pick a king? Well, it says there was a man, his name was Kish. And then it's going to give you his genealogy. the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Ephaniah, the son of, he was a Benjamite. And what kind of man was he? He was a mighty man of valor. The word in Hebrew, gibor hakil, gibor can be referred to a warrior. And we have many of those in our church, and I thank God for them, someone who stands in the gap and defends the nation. But when you wed it to the word hakil, it's referring not to a person who's a warrior, but a person who is great in the amount of things that they own, or translated, a landowner. So when it's talking about Kish, who's going to become the father of Saul in the passage, he's got money. I mean, Saul, the king, is the future king, is going to come from a family that's well-to-do. It says in verse 2, and he, Kish, had a son whose name was Saul. What kind of man was he? Just the kind of man you would want for king. What was he? Well, he was choice and handsome. Okay, we're going to pick him because of what he looks like. Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, and there was not a more handsome person than he among all the sons of Israel. Anything else? Well, from his shoulders up, he was taller than anybody else in the nation. I mean, huh? So there, God says, oh, you want a king? You want a king like the nations? How do kings pick nations? How do the nations pick kings? What they look like is important on the outside. What's God think when he's picking leaders? The heart, the character of the person. He says, oh, you want a king? I'll give you one. He's going to kind of be based on criteria that you will enjoy. There is not a better looking man in the entire country. And there's no one taller than him. So the leader, he's got to be at least 6'4", 6'5". Yeah, check. Yeah, square jaw, check. Dark black hair, check. Six pack, check. He's totally cut, check. Everything about him externally is a check. He just stands out. Is that why you should pick a leader? No, but that's the leader that they're going to get. Externally, he looked great. Internally, he's going to have huge issues. All right? It says in verse 3, we get to the donkey part. This is so interesting. It says, now the donkeys of Kish, because his dad had money, Saul's father, they were lost. And so Kish said to his son Saul, take now with you one of the servants and arise and go search for the donkeys. I need them back. I need them. I mean, they're worth a lot. So go find them. And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim, which is the tribe located just north of tribe of Benjamin. And he passed through the land of Salisha, and they didn't find him. They passed through the land of Sa'alim. They didn't find him there. They passed through the land of the Benjamites. They didn't find him there. And when they came to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, hey, come let us return, lest my father cease to be concerned about the donkeys and become more anxious for us. This leads to a whole lot of questions. Aren't those donkeys just cute? I mean, donkeys, I love donkeys. Donkeys are kind of fun. I have ridden donkeys in Israel in the Golan Heights before, near cliffs. Not a good idea. Because donkeys do whatever donkeys want to do. And I found that out that day. I had my whole tour group were on donkeys. And they told us, we trained them in Hebrew. You say this word, and they will stop when you get to the top of the cliffs. And you want to make them go, you say this in Hebrew. Okay. And I forgot what that was. So we got to the top of the cliff. I'm with my friend Rick Seeley, the head of Homicide, and we're approaching the cliff going down to the, 1,200 feet down to the Sea of Galilee. And I'm like, what's that word? And so we decided to just stop and tie our donkeys up to some trees and just walk the rest of the way. Because we looked back down the hill, and our tour group was all over the Golan Heights with their donkeys. Why? Donkeys do what donkeys want to do. Doesn't matter how much you kick them with your little legs around them, pull on the rope or whatever. They just, So how do these donkeys get lost? Probably not hard. Somebody left the barn door open, left the gate open. And if you leave a little opportunity for a donkey to take off, they're going to split. They're out of there. So they took off. Now, I would submit to you, did they leave on their own free will, or was God behind them getting lost? Well, what you're going to find is God allowed them to get lost, because he's going to allow Saul to follow the donkeys to go where God wants him to be so he can become the king. Now, it's kind of ironic, because God could have just come a little cloud bank over Saul and just come down to him and said, Saul, son of Kish, I want you to be the king. Go to Ramah to be crowned. He could have done that, right? God didn't do that. What does this teach you about God? He has a sense of humor, okay? I don't know how you think about him. He has a sense of humor. Some people come to church, and if I say anything funny, they're like, should I laugh at that? I don't know. I'm in church. I mean, God is humorous. Is he picks donkeys to guide Saul. It's most interesting. When you look at your life, all the little mundane things that happen to your life, it may not be a donkey that you're following, but it might be other things. And you must stop and ask yourself, is this mundane thing part of what God's doing in my life? You know, I mean, when you look at the unrelated events of your life, and then all of a sudden God brings them to center, it's like, you have got to be kidding. That's why I met that person in boot camp. That's why that was my commanding officer. That's why this, that's why that. This makes total sense. But at the time you're thinking, huh? Well, Saul is going to go look for donkeys and he's going to find a kingdom. So the same God that's going to guide the donkeys is the same God that's going to guide your life and all the mundane things. When we look at this passage in verses 6 to 7, it is what I call a proposition. It says, he said to him, because they can't find the donkeys. They don't know where the donkeys are. He said, my dad, we gotta leave because get back to my dad. He's going to be more concerned about us than the donkeys. Now, this, as a side note, tells you something about the character of Saul, the future king. He doesn't finish tasks. That's who you want in a leader, right? He doesn't finish tasks. Have you ever lived near someone that started projects and never finished them? It drives me insane. My first house I bought in California, the guy that lived next door to us, I love him. He's a great man. He loved projects. He never finished one of them. And then I tried to go sell my house, and you look next door. It's like, don't look next door. Just look at my house. Squared away. Yeah. Don't look over there. Somebody bought the house because over there was like project. None of them were done. And that's kind of like Saul's going to be. I'll listen to a point, but I don't typically follow through on things. So think about what it says there. It says, behold, there was a man of God in this city, and the man is held in high honor. All that he says comes true. Now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us about our journey in which we have set out. So Saul wants to go back home, and the servant wants to go find the donkeys. It's interesting. And he says, I know that there's a holy man that lives not far from here. And if we go to him, he'll be able to tell us where God is, because this prophet, well, they just know stuff because God tells them. And so he said, we need to go meet this holy man. And the holy man is going to be Samuel, as we're going to see in a minute. And he lives in the mountain town north of Jerusalem called Ramah. It's very interesting because the servant is telling Saul, the future king, about the holy man who's going to be Samuel. How famous was Samuel? Well, 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 20. Notice what it says. 1 Samuel 3, verse 20. It says, and all Israel from Dan, which is the northern part of the nation up near the Golan Heights, above the Golan Heights, actually, down to Beersheba, south of Gaza today, in the farthest city south, everyone in the nation knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. Everyone knew about the greatness of Samuel. Everybody except Saul. Saul, do you like politics? No. Do you like spirituality? No. What do you like to do? I'm just tall and good looking. Shallow. The guy is absolutely shallow. So everybody knew about the holy man, Samuel, except for Saul. It tells you something about his character. He's self-absorbed and clueless when his servant is not. In verse 7, Saul said to the servant, But behold, if we show up to this holy man, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone, and we ate all the food, from our sack, and there's no present to bring the man of God. What do we have? I mean, if we show up at the prophet's doorstep, I at least know I need to honor the prophet. Does this mean they were bribing the prophet? No. There's a tradition in America. I haven't quite, as a man, figured this out. I need to talk to the men for just a minute. Ladies, you can just sit there for just a moment. Someone invites you over for dinner, right? And you go over for dinner, and the wife goes out and buys something for the people in question. So I'm going over for dinner, and all of a sudden you're taking a plant. Or something. Do you understand what I'm talking about? And you're like, what's up with the plant? It's for the people. What for? They invited us over. Like, no, we need to honor them, right? Does this happen to you, or am I totally? You can't show up empty-handed. Yeah. So I've just learned over the years that when we get invited to somebody's house, you bring something with you as a present, right? Why are you bringing that, Harry? What would you say? You don't even know. You're in church right now, Harry. Yeah. Yeah, you're like, what? We don't do this. Yeah, you got to get in the groove here. You bring this over to honor the people that you're going to go see, whatever it is that you bring them. So that's all it is. It's nothing big. So he's at least showing honor to the prophet, which gives you a little taste of Saul. At least he knows he needs to do that, even though he's shallow. So what's their plan? Verses 8 to 10. The servant answered Saul again and said, behold, I have in my hand a fourth of a shekel of silver. I'm going to give it to the man of God, and he will tell us our way. And then it says parenthetically, formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he used to say, come, let us go to the seer, which in Hebrew means to be able to see. For he who is called the prophet now was formerly called the seer. Then Saul said to his servant, great idea. That's a great idea. Well said, come, let us go. So they went from the city where the man of God was. So this tells you a couple of things. Number one, it tells you that the servant is financially prepared based on a contingency plan. He has a shekel. He has silver in his pocket. Who came from a family with money and had no money? The future king had no contingency plan. I don't know. Do you work at the Pentagon? You can't tell me. Okay. Do you have contingency plans? I know you do. Because I've met many generals over the years, and I ask them, like, what kind of contingency plans do you have? Well, if this happens, this happens. This happens, that happens. It's all these contingency plans. Could you imagine picking the first king of your nation, and he doesn't plan ahead? He doesn't follow through. He's all absorbed with his looks, and he doesn't plan ahead. He didn't have any money. He's got no ATM card. He's got no charge card. He's got nothing. It's his servant that's planning ahead. Number two, this dynamic duo realized this man of God can see things because he's connected to God. And so what we do in a kind of a latent way, the author reminds you that the king should be a man who listens to the prophet. But if you study Israel's history, that's going to be the last thing they do. They're more concerned about politics than spirituality. And it's supposed to be the other way around. All of that little plan leads to what I call the positioning in verses 11 to 14. So they went up to the slope of the city. This is going to be Ramah, the mountain town about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. And they found young women going out to draw water. And they said to them, hey, is the seer here? And they answered them and said, he is. See, he just happens to be right ahead of you. Hurry now, for he has come into the city today, for the people have a sacrifice on the high place today. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now, therefore, go up and you will find him at once. So what did they do? Well, they went up to the city. And they came to the city, and behold, Samuel was coming out toward them to the high place. This just all happened by chance, right? I mean, think about this. God says, I want to get you, Saul, to become the next king. And I'm going to guide you to where you need to go. And you need to meet Samuel, who can anoint you. But I'm going to use donkeys to get you there. And then you're just going to happen to bump into some ladies who are walking out of Ramah to draw some water. And they just happen to know exactly where Samuel is. They're young ladies, not old ladies. They're young ladies. Don't you know that a young lady would stop to look at the nicest looking young man in the nation of Israel? I'm just saying, don't you think, look at him, he's 6'5". No one is that tall. And he's talking to us. What's he want to know? He wants to know where Samuel is. So he's right over there. Samuel just happened to be coming toward them. It's absolutely jaw-dropping. So it's the same in your life. All those little mundane things that you're experiencing, you need to stop and think, God, what are you telling me in all these events? You're lining me up to do something that I did not anticipate. Saul goes out to find donkeys and finds a kingdom. It's mind-boggling. The prophecy is a little parenthetical note God throws into the text before he gets to the main part of the story. It says, a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, about this time tomorrow, I will send a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel. He shall deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me. So he tells Samuel, the day before, I'm bringing the king to you. Didn't tell him how. He's trying to find donkeys, but he's coming to you, and I'll point him out to you when he arrives. That was going to be Samuel's replacement, that king. And so absolutely pivotal that he's going to run into this man. This is happening in verse 17, where we pivot to what I call the pick. God says, I'm going to position all of your lives, the donkeys, Saul and his servant traveling to Ramah, running into the young ladies. They happen to know exactly where Samuel is. Samuel's right up ahead of him. Everything is happening in proper sequence for their paths to cross. Verse 17 changes the whole story. It says, when Samuel saw Saul, then the Lord said to him, behold, the man whom I spoke to you. This is the one who shall rule my people. That's the man right there. The word for rule here is an interesting word. It's the word etzar. And if you study that word, it's not a positive use in the Old Testament. So there's another word he could have chosen for ruling and governing, but God, the Spirit, when he wrote this, didn't use that word. Why? I'll read to you the lexical meanings of that particular word in Hebrew, and you'll see how not positive that word is. Connotation number one, that word means to hold back and to hinder something. Second lexical meaning, it means to imprison somebody. Number three, it means to keep them imprisoned. Fourth lexical meaning, it means to keep something and retain it for yourself. Fifth lexical meaning, means to close and shut something, etc. Sound positive? No. It's because its use is primarily a negative connotation. Why did the Holy Spirit use that word and not another Hebrew word that has a positive connotation? Because he's telling you, oh, I'm going to give you a king, all right. And it's based on what he externally looks like. His character, he's shallow. He's not going to be like David that's going to come. And he's going to govern you, but it's going to be like you're in prison when he leads you. It's a taste of what is to come. It says in verse 18 Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, hey, could you please tell us where the seer's house is? Because he didn't know what Samuel looked like. And Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind. And as for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days, don't set your mind on them, for they've been found. Not a problem for a prophet to know that. How do you know that? God told him. And then he tells him, and for whom is it all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all of your father's household? This is like Saul's like, what did you just say? You found my donkeys, and then what did you just say to me? The NIV translation translates that cryptic verse this way. And on whom is the desire of all of Israel? Is it not on you and all of your father's house? Translated, the entire nation has been looking for you. You are famous. Huh? I'm just a country boy. I was looking for some donkeys. I just came here, me and my servant. And what are you talking about? He's telling him your name is a great name, and your family is a great name. And you can imagine that Saul has no idea what Samuel is talking about. Why? Because he's not paying attention to the mundane things and seeing how God's connecting them. Well, God's gonna help him, as God might help you in your life. Verse 21, I call it the perplexity, because notice Saul's response. Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest tribes of Israel? My family, well, they're the least of the families in the tribe of Benjamin. My dad holds a lot of land, but that's about it. Why then do you speak to me this way, as if I am somebody important? Well, he went out to go find donkeys, and he didn't know that the nation was looking for a king. He's going to become the king. Verses 22 to 24 is what I would label the privilege in the narrative. Samuel took Saul, his servant, and he brought them into this hall, this dinner hall. And he gave them a place where? Head of the table. He's probably just walking around dazed and confused. What? You want me to, You think my family's the greatest? We're the smallest tribe. And you want me to sit at the head of a table? What in the world is going on here? It says, Samuel then said to the cook, bring the portion that I gave you concerning which I said to you, set this aside. And the the cook took up a what? A leg. I don't know how you eat, but we're talking about a large piece of meat. He says, I want you to bring this leg with what is on it and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, here is what has been reserved. Set it before you and eat, because it has been kept for you until the appointed time. Pointed time? What time are you talking about? I just came to get some donkeys. He said, since I have invited the people, so Saul ate with Samuel that day. There's 30 people at the table. Who's at the head of it? A guy who was just looking for his dad's donkeys. So what in the world is going on here? Well, what is going on here? God's selecting a king and showing them their king. Oh, you want a king? I'll give you a king. Here's the king. Verse 25 is what I would call the pause, because you're not going to get a king in this chapter. It's going to be in the next chapter. And since next Sunday I start my Christmas series, we won't get to chapter 10 until January. You'll have to come back. You're like, I'm so frustrated. Yeah, just wait. We'll come to it. What's the pause? Well, notice what happens. It says, when they came down from the high place into the cities, Samuel spoke to Saul on the roof. And they rose early, and when it came about daybreak, that Samuel called to Saul on the roof, saying, get up, that I might send you away. So, which leads to, we don't sit around on our roofs, do we? I mean, my incline is, there's no way, I could barely climb up there. What's up with them? Well, in those houses, if you study that, the flora and fauna and how they lived back then, their houses were flat with a parapet wall around the perimeter so you didn't fall off. And you typically slept up there because in a hot region, it's cooler up there. So that's where Saul bedded down for the night. He called up to Saul on the roof and said, get up that I might send you away. So Paul arose, both he and Samuel went out into the street. And as they were going down to the edge of the city, Samuel said to Saul, say to your servant that he might go ahead of us and pass on, but you remain standing now that I might proclaim to you the word of God. I have something to tell you. It's going to radically change your life. You came looking for donkeys, and God has guided you here. Something amazing is going to happen in chapter 10. He's going to be anointed the king. What does all this tell you? It tells you this particular motif from this passage. What does it say? You can read it. It's English. God works how? Silently through what? Mundane events of your life. To do what? To accomplish the marvelous. Do you believe that? I do. I've seen him do it in my life. Sometimes it takes him years. But then when God connects all those loose dots in your life, then it makes total sense when they come center. Because what does God want to do? He wants to do something marvelous in your life. You just have to have the patience and the faith to watch him work. He does all that because he's providential. Down to the smallest of details. Saul was about to find that out. Back on January 10th, 1948, there was a man. His name was Marcel Sternberger. He jumped on a train in Brooklyn in the subway. He wanted to visit a friend that was sick. The train was full. When the doors opened, there was no seat. He couldn't even get in. All of a sudden, a man jumped out of a seat and ran out of the car. So he ran in and sat down. The man sitting next to him was reading a Hungarian newspaper. Marcel was Hungarian. So if you are Hungarian and someone's reading a Hungarian newspaper next to you and you're an extrovert, what do? Start talking to this guy in Hungarian. So they did. They began to talk. Had a great conversation for 30 minutes. The man sitting next to Marcel's name was Paskin. Paskin began to share his tragic story from World War II. What happened? Well, Paskin was a law student prior to the start of World War II. Eventually, he wound up in a labor battalion and was sent to Ukraine. The Russians eventually overran that particular region, captured him, and forced him for the rest of the war to bury dead German soldiers. After the war, he walked hundreds of miles home to Debrecen in Hungary, looking for his mom and dad and his brothers and sisters. He went to his house, and there were strangers living in it. He then walked to where he and his wife used to live. Strangers were living in it. Neighbors came and approached him and said, we're sorry to tell you this, but your mom, your dad, your brothers, your sister, your wife, they were all hauled off to Auschwitz. They didn't make it. Marcel was listening to this story from this man as they're riding on the train that day, and he thought it sounded very, very similar. Why? Well, not long before that, he had been at a friend's house, and he met a young woman. Who told her that she was from the city of Debrecen, and that she had also spent time in Auschwitz, and that instead of her dying in Auschwitz, the Germans took her and stuck her in a munitions factory. Her family had died in Auschwitz, but she had lived. And after the war, she took a boat in 1946 to New York. He was so captivated by her story, he wrote her name down and her address and her phone number. Turning to Mr. Paskin, Marcel looked at him and said, I need to ask you a question. Is your first name Bella? Paskin about passed out. He's like, how did you know that? And he said, well, was your wife's name Maria? The guy couldn't even breathe. He's like, how did you know my wife's name? How did you know my first name? And he said, well, I met her. she's very much alive. They took the next train stop and got off and went like you used to. You had to go find a phone. They went and found a telephone. Who do you think they called? They called his wife. She answered the phone. And, you know, it's one of those awkward conversations where Marcel's like, remember me from the dinner party? Yeah, I have somebody that I think you need to talk to. It was her husband. Who was on the train car that day? God. The Lord rode the rails that day. Hungarian man reading a newspaper. Another Hungarian man jumps on. Just seems arbitrary and mundane. And God's arranging these men to rendezvous because he wants to reunite a husband and a wife. That's the greatness of God. That's the kind of God I serve. It's the kind of God that you know. If you're looking at the mundane things of your life thinking, what in the world? God's telling you today something marvelous is going to happen. Just trust me and watch.